Alrighty, Truth About Markets, New Zealand with Max and Stacy. Stacy, what's happening?
Hey, you said my name like four times.
I did. Yeah. Well,
is there something up with that? Hey, you know, you and I have been like the only people down here, down under, talking about Paul Watson, Captain Paul Watson, and his adventures down in Antarctic Circle.
Yep.
Looking to save the whales. Well, he's had a massive success. Japan has announced that they've cut in half their whale catch this year. They only managed to catch 500 whales, and they say this with a lot of anger. They in their press conference, they said that they blame the violent actions of Captain Paul Watson and his crew on the Sea Shepherd.
Right. Well, yes, Captain Paul Watson needs to be commended for this triumph against the Japanese whalers. Absolutely.
Now we need him to get his ship and go between the bankers and their prey.
Yeah. So there's a big harbor down there in Wall Street.
The bankers are slaughtering the helpless Ponzi's and victims, the pension funds, the citizens of their nations.
With their CDO harpoon missiles.
Exactly.
Harpoon cannons of CDO, collateralized debt nonsense.
So when we interview him, we're hoping to get an interview soon.
Yeah.
Where we should ask him about this.
Paul Watson always says that his whole motivation is economic, which is something we have been trying to get into this activist space for a long time. You know, that you need to introduce economics into the equation so you have a metric to know whether or not you're succeeding or not. Paul Watson says at the end of the season, the Japanese whale catch was down X percentage and it cost them so many dollars. Now, this is the only guy in the world of activism that's willing to put a number onto his activism and compete with the bad guys with something that's better. Everybody else is out there saying, well, morally this, morally that, ethically this, ethically that. We're a witness to this. We're a witness to that. Oh, let's draw the world's attention over here. Okay, none of that adds up to anything because there's no numbers attached to it. We live in a world driven by numbers. Paul Watson is willing to put a number to it, and that's why I think he's been incredibly successful because he has a goal. He goes out there and he achieves his goal, and it's fighting fire with fire. The Japanese whalers are out there trying to extract as much of this whale meat as possible for as many yen as they possibly can, even though it violates international law. Captain Watson is out there on behalf of the whales trying to diminish that count as much as he possibly can, and in so doing, he's acting not only on behalf of the whales, but he's acting on behalf of humanity. He's acting on behalf of anybody out there who values the global ecosystem as a means to providing the necessary air, oxygen, and water to survive.
Well, who also values diversity and the rule of law, because that's the other thing that is a good analogy to the financial system. Is there are laws on the book, and Japan is technically breaking them, but nobody's enforcing it. And they could break it just flagrantly. Well, the same thing is going on in our financial system. The laws are being broken flagrantly, but nobody's there to enforce it. You have to, no matter how much you try to convince your governments, your politicians, your regulators to do something, they say, oh, it's too complex, it's too difficult, there's no real, it's hard to prove, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, the flags of convenience analogy is a good one. In the shipping industry, when one company ships some oil to another country, they use a ship that's registered in a country to a shell company that's owned by another company owned in another territory in another shell company. So if, in fact, the ship goes aground and there's an accident, nobody claims ownership of the ship. So nobody has any accountability. In the financial space, when banks package collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and all these manner of derivatives, and they swap them back and forth through shell companies, or as Lehman Brothers called its castle bank down the street, and what do they call it? Not an orphan bank, but a weasel bank or something. They don't have to take any accountability for it because it's a bank of convenience that they just shovel all their risk into that. And when it blows up, they put a gun to the head of Congress, as Hank Paulson did, and get a huge bailout.
Exactly. But also, the other thing I noticed this week with, these credit derivatives that are toxic and fraudulent is a lot of them are starting to blow up in Europe. And sure enough, you know, in many of these cases, like there's this town in Germany, Forchheim, also known as Gold City for its fame for jewelry making.
Oh, yeah.
And they've basically been blown up by some debt credit derivatives.
Yeah.
Debt bombs sold to them by, I believe it was J.P. Morgan. But sure enough, the contract was only 7 pages long. And on page 5, in bold, actually, was that your losses may be unlimited.
That sounds bad.
So, and yet the town still bought it. So, but how can you sell a product like that to something like a town? Which, how has this happened? How do you stop that from happening?
Well, even the Financial Times makes a reference to Goldman Sachs saying that at best, you could say that they were a dodgy used car salesman selling faulty products knowingly to an unsuspecting public. I mean, that's a pretty low characterization of a bank that considers itself to be doing God's work. You know, we make the analogy to the sausage business and the meatpacking industry that, you know, basically we explained it on one of our previous episodes. But
this is all they have to do then. You know, the regulations come in and they say, oh, you know, we put that there. It's in bold on page 5 that, you know, your losses can be unlimited. But, I mean, should they even be selling a product to it's a town that needs to survive, that has huge public obligations?
Okay.
You know, shouldn't there be some sort of like more than just in the print, in the even if it's written down, shouldn't it be like, dude, listen, just so you realize, you are spending these people's money, the town's money, and you could lose more than your principal. You could lose $1 trillion.
Well, it's the insidious nature of CNBC and CNBC Europe. These shows play everywhere in Europe and all over the world, and they have these beautiful women giving stock quotes and bond quotes and fiery, energetic guys like James Cramer stomping around, and they legitimize and they normalize this idea that markets are something that we are as a part of our life and that we can trust them and they're inevitable and you simply need to accept it. So when these salesmen go into these towns and they say, here's a collateralized debt obligation, fakakta, triple out of the money, butterfly spread, collateralized by belly button lint, nowheresville, nothing. And the guy says, yeah, but it's advertised on CNBC. They're like, okay, I'd like to buy some, please. And they end up loading the gills, loading them up to the gunnels with all this junk. I haven't said that in a while. Loading it up to the gunnels. You see, it's a tip-off that I grew up around a lot of people with a lot of yachts. You know, you use this phrase often. They load it to the gunnels with all that bad debt. You got carried out on a stretcher.
But it's also part of that whole U.S. lawsuit culture too. So they're, you know, most people just ignore warnings because they're all over everything. Warning, you know, if you walk along the sidewalk, you might trip and fall and break your head. Warning, if you cross the street, you might get hit by a car.
Cigarette will kill you.
Warning, yeah, this cigarette. Yeah, in the UK, it's like, it has to get more and more absurd. They have pictures of charred lungs and pictures of mouths filled with, you know, cancer, and you know, you could die horrible deaths, and that doesn't stop. You know, people just like they stop reading or listening to those or understanding.
And the people who buy these things who represent the towns are typically folks who it's considered to be not a very interesting job to have. I mean, they just sit behind a desk and read, you know, prospectuses all day. These are not highly successful people. If they were more successful, they would be in the banking side. They would be sellers, not buyers. They would be on the sell side, not on the buy side. And so they sit down there and in comes the Wall Street salesman and they take him out to dinner and they give him a glass of wine and they tell him how great everything is. And
they tell them, oh yeah, order the 5,000 euro bottle of wine.
Yeah, oh, it's on me.
Yeah.
You know, he's making a $20 million fee and he's about to put the bank into a 50-year frozen debt, state of non-existence.
Well, with that,
we're
going to be non-existent for the next 2 minutes, okay?
Oh, my God.
Be right back.
It's a ghost.
We are once again existent.
We're back.
Max Kaiser.
Yeah, so Goldman Sachs, the SEC is charging them with fraud. And this is, of course, inspiring lots of lawyers to go out there and file potentially lots of criminal cases against Goldman Sachs for people who lost money as part of
But lawyers can only file civil cases. They can't. It's up to the department. It's up to the attorney general to file criminal charges.
And this would be I'm not watching enough of these crime shows. So the attorney general in this case is Andrew Cuomo.
Well, Goldman Sachs is the O.J. Simpson of the banking world. Mm-hmm. So O.J. Simpson was tried for murder first by the attorney general, the district attorney. They were the ones that filed criminal charges. The jury was very, shocked by his celebrity, and they were apparently, impressed, and they found him innocent.
If the bonds fit, you must acquit.
And then it was the Goldman family and Nicole Brown's family sued him in civil court for several $1 million, and he was found guilty there obliged to pay.
All right, so the attorney general has to file charges, criminal charges. Now, in this case, I believe the attorney general covering this is Andrew Cuomo.
Andrew Cuomo. And I think also the other option would be the Department of Justice, I think. I'm not sure 100% on this, but I think that, especially because it's cross-border and cross-continents. Actually,
cross-state.
Because the Goldman fraud, it all blew up outside of the U.S.
Interstate.
So perhaps, I don't know, because it blew up almost entirely in the UK. So of the $1 billion fraud, $841 million was to Royal Bank of Scotland. Yeah. And another $150 million was to a German bank, IKB.
So these venues, why aren't there criminal charges being charged in these various countries right now? Exactly. Like Greece, for example. Greece, of course, was victimized by Goldman in 2000. And as a result, the country is now going to be taken over by the IMF. Now, why can't Greece launch a criminal indictment against Goldman Sachs for fraudulent inducement and peddling fraudulent securities?
Yeah, because these nations, and, I see it in places like London, where I could speak the language and I could read the papers and I could watch the news. And I see that all the time you're told that we can't get rid of these guys, but we want them here, in fact, because they're rich and they spend so much money.
Look, some parasites in your belly are good for you. Some of them are not good for you. Now, the argument that Goldman Sachs is a good parasite that we need to oblige doesn't work anymore. It's a bad parasite. We need to get rid of them. It's this huge tapeworm crawling up the entrails of humanity.
Oh, Max Kaiser.
I am Max Kaiser. None are wiser.
Okay, Max is with the midway point of the show. Max is flipped. He's gone crazy.
Well, I used to work at Oppenheimer and Company, so it was like, "Oh, it's Max Kaiser from Oppenheimer." Had a nice ring to it.
Does it?
Kinda. That's where I was working during the crash of '87.
Yeah, well, nothing. You can't really have a crash of '87 like situation anymore, can you? Because of the stop. Yeah.
No, they put in the collars, you mean, to prevent the markets from collapsing. But they actually got rid of those.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they quietly kind of got rid of those.
Oh, okay. So that one day fall in 87, October 87, how much was the?
20%.
28%?
No, 20%.
20%.
Yeah.
So the worst day of this financial crisis in 2008 was something like 777 points.
That's nothing.
Which was less than 10%.
That's right. Less than 10%, yeah. Yeah, no, you need a 2,000 to 3,000 point drop to really have the same shock value as you did on October of 1987, October 19th, 1987. Very memorable day. You know, I was in my office in Midtown Manhattan in the Exxon building overlooking Rockefeller Center and eating a nice cheese sandwich at my desk, watching the guy next to me fall over from drinking too much booze the night before. And you're watching the world collapse in real time. It left quite an impression. Now, as a result, the next day, Alan Greenspan, Ronald Reagan, and Robert Rubin created the Working Group of Finance to allow the U.S. government...
Working Group on Financial Markets.
That's right. Allow the federal government to buy S&P futures contracts, the SPX. And at that moment... crossed a very important line in the history of American free market capitalism, because up until that moment, the government was illegal for the government to be an active participant in the markets as such, buying and selling in this way. And this is when it all changed. And they, what then became known as the Plunge Protection Team, which is what they call this group now. This meets every month, just like the Federal Open Market Committee meets. They've got huge resources, and they steer prices according to which way they want to see prices going. So it's just part of the evolution or devolution of American markets to Politburo-style fixed pricing, communist Soviet communist era, gulag, casino gulag. It's a casino gulag. Now, we've seen on this show many things, and we've talked about many things. And most of the time, the people listening to this show have stood there with their jaws agape, staring out the window into the middle distance and wondering to themselves, why can't I get that other show that I like so much?
Well, you know, I was just thinking of a little story about the past week, was that we were scheduled to interview this guy from Thailand who did some fantastic stuff. But I do want to say that, you know, it's not all doom and gloom here, because we do have quite a few luxuries that you don't have in many other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And that is the Thai government issued a statement saying that any person in Thailand who speaks to the press and broadcasts it over the internet or anywhere on the internet, including Twitter or Facebook, they said faces, you know, a very stiff sentence, up to 20 years in prison for even saying anything that they deem was negative about the country.
Yeah.
So we had a fantastic young journalist guy who we were going to speak to, but mm-hmm. he had to back out because he wasn't even able, you know, because it wasn't clear like what you can and can't talk about. He was afraid to even say who the red shirts are, who the yellow shirts are while being in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when we were in Bangkok, you know, the people we met, like the tour guide, you know, almost every other word out of his mouth was that, yes, the king is a benevolent king.
And we were told by a Thai friend of mine before we went there, it's like, really, whatever you do, do not make fun of the king. Do not, like, don't even talk about him, because right. you could end up in jail, really, for 20 years. So we were unprepared for, basically, we felt like we were being taunted because everybody kept on bringing up the king and saying, we have a benevolent king. And you were just, like, afraid to laugh, and you just had to nod and just say, like,
yes, yes, the king is benevolent. Yes, yes.
Don't
indeed.
Throw me
yes,
in jail.
Yes, I don't shoot. Don't shoot. The king is benevolent. Yes, of course he is. I just said that a minute ago. You should have heard me. I was just telling my friend down the street, the king is a benevolent king. Don't look at me.
But of course, which is must be a very surreal situation there, because all of the turmoil is essentially about the fact that the king is basically on his deathbed at the moment. And his son, who is due to secede him, is hated.
What?
So he's hated.
Oh, really?
So at the moment, I mean, the king himself is treated almost as a semi-deity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have this huge conflict in Thailand between the masses of the poor and the small middle class elite. They basically hate each other because obviously they have different, wants.
Mm-hmm.
But the king has always stepped in at the last minute as things escalated to the point of conflict.
Well, he's a benevolent king.
He's a benevolent king. He would step in and he would tell people to stop hurting each other. And they had to obey him.
Right.
But now everybody's fearing that it's going to be all insane because the prince who will become king, mm-hmm. is hated.
Yeah, until he becomes king. Then he becomes a new benevolent king.
No. He's hated. And everybody's apparently was advised. This is from what I learned in The Economist, is that everybody was advising the king to appoint his daughter, the princess, who is very loved in the country.
All right, we're going to talk about the princess in a second. Let's break for a music. All right, we're back. Yeah, so princess in Thailand versus the prince. What, tell us more.
But from his hospital bed, the king has said that his son will secede him,
mm-hmm.
And he's hated. So anyway, this could bring conflict to that whole region because it's obviously combustible situation there.
Yeah. Now, in 98, they had the huge financial crisis. And yeah. Thai baht, you know, collapsed. It's not a financial crisis.
No, because the Thai baht is strong. Apparently, it's like at pretty much all-time highs.
Along with these other Asian currencies.
Yeah.
And so it's a political crisis, and the Thai baht is strong. And
And I know a lot of Kiwis go travel to that area of the world. It's a very popular region with a...
Yeah, we had a lot of fun there.
Oh, God, I loved it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I was there a couple once before, so I was kind of like ready to kind of sink into the atmosphere right away. Because it's the first time you're there. It's kind of shocking, you know, coming from the West. And it's just so overwhelming. It's so different in Asia and in Bangkok. And just everything is so, so different there. But that was the second time I'd been there. And so I just really fell right into it right away, and it just let it wash over me. It's just this fantastic experience, really. And, you know, a lot of interesting sights and sounds and smells and food, and the people are so gracious. And the minibar at the hotel was incredibly stocked. I mean, you know, you open up the minibar, and you expect those little mini bottles of Chivas Regal or Johnnie Walker Black. Okay, this minibar in Bangkok, when you open it up, it had full bottles of everything you could possibly want. Okay, now that's a mini bar.
That was really crazy. The best watermelon juice, but also it was really the smells. It's the smell of Bangkok. It smells like pepper.
Pepper,
like,
yeah.
It's just it's in your nose, constantly irritating it a little bit, but in a nice way. It's really quite nice.
It's peppery, and all those people on the streets. Remember, like a woman was standing on the sidewalk next to a cardboard box. All prim and proper, nicely dressed, hair pulled back, nice smile, holding a single apple.
Yes.
For sale.
Yeah, it's a genuine kind of like free market system.
But that was it. That was her entire, you know, inventory of goods was that apple.
And I remember there are also like people along the side of the street with their sewing machines.
Right.
If you need any, your shirt sewn up or something or...
No, I read somewhere in San Francisco that some guy is on the street with a sewing machine doing all kinds of sewing jobs. He really loves sewing and this type of thing, and he's become
I like
an
that. You know, hold on one second. Well, we're back. Speaking of traveling salesmen.
Yeah. Somebody's just trying to sell Stacy some shoes.
We're not joking either. Anyway.
Yeah. What the heck were... Oh, Bangkok. Yes, Bangkok. Beautiful. We have to go back someday. We were... remember, we stopped over in Qatar in Doha.
That's right. And then we went there. But also Asia's in the news because the reports this past week were that China's GDP from the first quarter annualized would be 11.9% growth.
Oh, yeah.
Singapore up 32.1%.
That's amazing.
Well, it was the crash really affected them deeply because, you know, there was zero trade in financial products, which Singapore is a main financial services hub. But also there's a lot of, you know, shipping traffic that goes through Singapore. And that, we know, came to a complete standstill.
Right, exactly. Right. So they the comparisons were impressive. Because they had such a sharp decline.
They had a much sharper decline than what we do. So
Singapore is a nice place. I've been there too, you know.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't been there.
I was at the Raffles Hotel, of course, famous for the Singapore Sling. To keep on this liquor theme.
And you don't even drink.
Well, you know, I try to avoid it. You know, I prefer heroin. You know, a little speedballing with some cocaine, maybe.
Anyway, actually, if anybody out there listening is from Malaysia, that's where we'd like to go next, Kuala Lumpur. So we should get ourselves invited there.
Yeah, anyone in Kuala Lumpur, we want to go visit there next. And if you, what was the question?
If you want to entice us to come there.
Well, yeah, we'll do the show there. We'll do any show in Kuala Lumpur, you know, just set up in your living room. And we can actually do the broadcast. You know, there's an auction over there at Residence 104, and they're auctioning off a limited edition poster, Max and Stacy poster from our Paris Live Radio day.
Yeah, well, maybe we should announce this on our other show.
Well, this is, you know, there's a lot of people listening to both shows. So, you know, you can check that out. And then on RDU, that was what I was going to say, is RDU is where the show we're on now here in Christchurch in New Zealand. If they ever did have an auction, you know, we'd be happy to contribute something to it.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, I wonder how what the funding is. So if if they need funding, they should let us know.
Yeah, we'll be, for example, the pair of shoes that someone just tried to sell us. We could put those up for auction for the RDU if they ever had an auction, you know. Look, and of course, the joint is in New Zealand.
The joint is on RDU.
That's right. It's a fantastic situation. These guys are geniuses.
Max, you're thinking of the Singapore Sling, and you've gone totally crazy now. And he's
more like Eggs Benedict.
So anyway,
Breakfast
but we haven't
champions.
Heard of it. You know, we started off speaking about the Goldman Sachs fraud.
Yeah.
Has any Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan, you know, they've been packaging all these interest rate swaps and credit default swaps to Citis, and those are now blowing up across Europe. But I wonder if they've sold any of them to New Zealand. I know that there were quite a few in Australia, which recently blew up.
Right.
Those were all mostly from Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch, I think. But I haven't ever seen a story or come across a story yet about, you know, Wall Street derivatives blowing up in the streets of Christchurch. So if you have those kind of stories, you could send them to us at max@maxkaiser.com or stacy@maxkaiser.com.
Well, you know, the film industry is becoming big in New Zealand. It has big. You know, they've got Peter Jackson, and they did the Lord of the Rings. Now, on the front of derivatives trading, of course, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission just approved box office futures contract to start trading. And this will probably wipe out the Australian, New Zealand, and Canadian film market.
That's your prediction.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. These are going to blow up within 2 years. And it'll have a material impact on territories such as New Zealand with a film industry that they feed into the Hollywood model. So you can buy Lord of the Rings futures contracts. It'll be speculated by hedge funds, and they'll be leveraged 20, 30, 40 to 1. They'll blow up, and they'll need a bailout, and the entire industry will need to be. They already have, as part of the language in this legislation, that if they blow up, they won't be able to get government bailout money.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
So they already know that they're going to blow up. And of course, once you blow up, you can't say, well, you no bailout money for you, because they'll just say, oh my God.
Yeah, that really worked on all of those Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds, which at the bottom, in big lettering, right, wrote, these are not backed by the U.S. government.
Right.
Of course they were. So this also goes back to our story where we were talking about all these debts blowing up across Europe. In their case, J.P. Morgan argues that, well, on page 5 of the 7-page contract, we write in big letters that your losses may be unlimited. Well, you know, maybe these people also were holders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds and say, yeah, well, those warnings didn't actually mean anything either.
No, they don't mean anything. The only thing that means anything is gold bullion. Okay, until next time. Bye, y'all.